So speaking of great questions, we want to move now and talk about prostate cancer. So much going on there. We have a great faculty, as we have for all of our programs here today. So joining us up here on the stage, Dr. Neeraj Agarwal from the University of Utah Huntsman Cancer Institute in Salt Lake City, Utah, and Dr. Alan Bryce from the Translational Genomics Research Institute at the City of Hope, Phoenix, Arizona, and Uday Dandamoni back again from the Florida Cancer Specialist, Newport Richey, Florida. So I want to start out, you know, we have this sort of little running joke about sort of making the faculty say, that's a really great question. I hear something. And we were just at the ASCO GU meetings, and sometimes what we do is I'll sit down with an investigator ahead of time and ask them, oh, do you have any questions you'd like to ask the faculty? And we video record it, and then we play the questions during the meeting. So at the GU meeting, we were doing a program on prostate cancer, actually, as I mentioned this before, an AKT, capivasertib, et cetera. We had Dr. Vizazi, who was the PI on the study, and Dr. George and Dr. Heath. And actually, Neeraj. I met with him ahead of time and did a video and showed his questions. And when I sat down with him and he started asking questions, and when he was done, he'd asked me 43 questions. So we played most of them and put the rest of them up as slides. I thought you might, but you haven't seen what actually happened, so I thought you might find this interesting.
How early in prostate tumorigenesis does PTEN loss occur? And do you view this primarily as an initiating event or a driver of disease progression? What is the real-world frequency of PTEN loss in localized disease versus metastatic disease? How often do you see intra-patient heterogeneity when PTEN status differs between the primary tumor and metastasis? In 2026, what is the most practical way to assess PTEN loss in routine practice? Is it IHC, tumor NGS, or ctDNA testing?
Neeraj forgot one question, but yes. Dan will answer for sure. Yeah. Does God exist?
And yeah, I really appreciate it. That was an incredible experience for all of us. All right, so we're going to talk about prostate cancer. We're going to start out focusing on hormonal therapy, obviously a mainstay, but just like when we spent 2 hours this morning talking about hormonal therapy of breast cancer, I think we could spend 2 hours talking about hormonal therapy of prostate cancer with everything going on here. But Alan, let's talk about some of the data.
Yeah, happy to get into it. Thanks for having me. All right, so here are my disclosures. We'll get into things. So the general structure here, we'll start out talking about a pair of trials in the non-metastatic space, right? So non-metastatic, remember, in the prostate cancer world is referring to that space between initial therapy, be it surgery or radiation, and that period of time where you see PSA recurrence suggesting that there's recurrent disease, but we don't see metastases yet, right? Now, non-metastatic is simply the term we use to describe this state. Biologically, of course, it is metastatic. It's micrometastatic, perhaps, right? If you get past the salvage radiation and you get past the point where you think it might be local recurrence. But the definition of non-metastatic is being challenged by the advent of PET scanning, right, which allows us to see earlier and earlier disease. So the parenthetical point here is that non-metastatic is defined by conventional imaging. All of our studies that define this space are using CT and bone scan, not PET scanning, right? When we get to a point where, and we'll get to it, where PET scanning is redefining the space, then we have to think about our data. But this data is really based upon conventional imaging. So the pair of studies we talk about first EMBARK, this is our study that's looking at the use of enzalutamide in this early disease space. Three-arm study, so the control arm is going to be placebo plus LHRH therapy. Then you're going to have two experimental arms. Arm one, enzalutamide with leuprolide. Arm three, enzalutamide monotherapy. A one-to-one-to-one design. The primary endpoint is metastasis-free survival as defined by conventional imaging, right? So not PSA progression, different than how we've thought about this in previous studies. High-risk patients as defined by PSA doubling time. Most men with biochemical recurrence do not need to be treated because they have long PSA doubling times and they don't die of prostate cancer. But as the doubling time gets short, we know that death from prostate cancer becomes more likely. That's why our trials are designed this way. So doubling time had to have been less than 9 months, no metastases by conventional imaging. And what you see in this study, again, metastasis-free survival. So what they did was they start patients on the three arms. If patients have a profound PSA response, which most should, then they get to come off study at week 37. They're monitored. They're eventually restarted on treatment, and they continue on treatment until metastasis by conventional imaging versus remaining on treatment indefinitely if you have an incomplete response. Both experimental arms compared to the control arm. And what you see is a positive study for metastasis-free survival. Both enzalutamide arms outperform LHRH therapy alone. Unequivocal, very good hazard ratios here. When we look at the secondary endpoints, overall survival also favors the enzalutamide arm, the combination arm, kind of less impressive when we talk about the enzalutamide monotherapy. And then, there's kind of this soft secondary endpoint of time to first antineoplastic therapy, but that's not specified. That's physician choice, right? So there's a lot of variables that feed into that. This is now an approved therapy. So enzalutamide is approved across the spectrum of prostate cancer for your biochemical patients. Enzalutamide monotherapy is certainly an option for you based upon the EMBARK data. The toxicities are familiar. This is what we've seen with enza in the past, right? So you have a proportion of patients who will get that CNS toxicity, right? The asthenia, fatigue, some brain fog. You get some cardiovascular toxicity with some increased hypertension, et cetera. And then the endocrine toxicities, right? There's the hot flashes and whatnot.
So before we go on, I just want to talk a little bit about the EMBARK study. This is one of my favorite studies of all time. When that came out, I was just like floored. What an incredible study. But Neeraj, one of the problems is we've kind of figured out after the fact that most of these people actually had metastatic disease. I mean, we sort of knew that because they had PSA recurrence. But we know that if you look at patients like that, the vast majority of them are PSMA positive. And more we're seeing, and forgive me for using the old terminology. I know these guys came up with the new term. I always was an androgen pathway modulator, naive and sensitive, but I'm going to stick with hormone sensitive for a while. But anyhow, it just made that whole, people either have never had de novo or they've never had hormone therapy or they had it a long time ago, but whatever you want to call it, they're still sensitive to hormones. That whole scenario now is like blown up from my point of view. So first of all, you have the possibility theoretically of using intermittent therapy now, as demonstrated with EMBARK. Theoretically, you have enzalutamide monotherapy, although it was, quote, PSMA recurrence. Now you have PARP in that space. We're going to talk about capivasertib in that space. So getting very complicated. How do you think through the patient who's just PSMA positive? Maybe they had, surgery or radiation in the past. They've been followed very carefully. They're picked up as soon as the PSA increases. Their CAT scan, everything's negative, but the PSMA scan is positive. How do you think through their therapy at this point?
That's a great question.
Exactly.
So knowing the time limit I have, I'll just focus on something which I got from EMBARK trial, which is the ability to use enzalutamide as a monotherapy in those patients who are very reluctant to start androgen deprivation therapy or who are scared of low testosterone. So that's number one. Number two, after 6 to 9 months of treatment, if I see great response using the EMBARK trial data, I'm more willing to take a break from this treatment. So that's second. And number three, EMBARK just allows me to use these therapies in those patients who do not have CT or bone scan positive disease. Because sometimes you have PSMA positive disease, do not have anything on CT and bone scans. That's not how all these drugs were approved. So now there's no pushback from the insurance companies because of the EMBARK, I can use these therapies up front. Now, talking about your specific question on PSMA, PET positive disease, CT negative disease, bone scan negative disease. That's the area of active investigation. Can we allow these patients to be treated with radiation therapy to oligometastatic disease and delaying androgen deprivation therapy is a hugely attractive option for all of us. And we are doing that on an ad hoc basis, but we need high-level evidence for that.
Now, that's a great point about the oligomet. I hear that all the time from the prostate cancer people. Alan, what about this issue of intermittent therapy? Do people really benefit quality life-wise? Do they feel better? And are you using it more liberally now since we saw the EMBARK data?
All right. So what I would say is that in the biochemically recurrent space, intermittent has always been the standard, right? And I think EMBARK shows that very well and makes a lot more people comfortable with it. But it's always been the standard. If we go back to, you know, all of our studies just using LHRH therapy in the BCR space. So in BCR, I guess here's how I'd frame it for people, just to step back and think about the big picture. So when I counsel a patient, the first thing I tell them is, in biochemically recurrent disease, the vast majority of men will die of something other than their prostate cancer. You don't need treatment. Okay. Now, we have data sets, and it goes back to the doubling time question, and I'll circle back to the intermittent then. But you look at the old VA data set, you look at the old Mayo Clinic data set, these are data sets with over 100,000 men. These are massive data sets to say what happens in biochemical recurrence. And it's very clear. If you have a PSA doubling time of 2 years or greater, then the likelihood of metastatic disease is about 10% at 10 years. In a man at 75, 10% at 10 years is fine. Don't touch him, right? Now, if the doubling time is 3 months or less, then the likelihood of metastatic disease is about 50% at 3 years. Completely different. And once a man has metastatic disease, then his likelihood of dying of prostate cancer is 80-90%. So metastatic disease by conventional imaging is the inflection point where a man crosses from you're not going to die of this to you're probably going to die of this. And it changes the conversation. Now, on that grade of doubling times, the inflection point where the risk really starts to rise is somewhere around 8 to 10 months. That's why you see us use that in the clinical trials. But having said that, when we do intermittent therapy for high-risk BCR, still thinking about it by conventional imaging, you know, we get a good 5 to 7 years in most of these men with intermittent therapy before they develop metastatic disease. It's a long path. So it has always been my standard of care to do intermittent. Now, you can ask, is it 6 months, 9 months, 12 months? There's several different clinical trials out there that did it differently. So I tell my men, it's not set in stone. Mentally, think about it as 12 months, but we're going to just assess it 3 months at a time based upon your PSA. And then we stop. And what happens, right, is a couple of things. Each off period becomes shorter and shorter as the disease becomes more aggressive, right? As oncologists, we all understand that. The time to testosterone recovery gets longer and longer. The older the patient gets, the more he's exposed to ADT. So, you know, I really, if we can get a PSA of zero, which we should, you know, maybe I'll treat 3 months beyond that and then back off. Most men will have testosterone recovery. Quality of life improves. Bone health improves. Metabolic health improves. Intermittent therapy is absolutely the standard. I would vehemently disagree with the idea of continuous therapy in the BCR setting.
Uday, any questions? And also, I'm curious about your experience. You have people who really push back on LHRH. Have you ever used Enzo alone?
Yeah.
So definitely, like in general hematology oncology, that's one of the common patients we see is like patients coming with rising PSA, but no clear evidence of metastatic disease. The question for you guys is like, what is the threshold? Like, I know PSA less than 0.2, you stop the treatment. When do you restart? Like, what is that? Do you look at the velocity with which the PSA is going up, or what threshold do you restart the PSA, restart the ADT?
So, again, there's no rule out there, but we pick up a value. 10, 20, these values have been used in different trials in the past, in the SWOG trial, in the PR 09 trial, the Canadian trial, I think. So there are different values. For me, I look at the baseline value. If that is more than 10 or 20, then I go with 10 or 20. We always have a rule so that patients don't fall through the cracks. If somebody has a baseline PSA of less than 10, then I like to stick to that baseline PSA. So many patients have metastatic disease or if they had metastatic disease or PSMA PET positive disease or PSA 5 or 7, I stick to that value. So go to less than 0.2, stop treatment, and then restart whenever that predefined value is reached. And I'd just like to add one more thing. I really like GnRH antagonist, just building up on what Alan mentioned, because if you use Relugolix or Dagrelix, then the testosterone recovery is much faster. And with Eligard and Lupron shots, testosterone doesn't recover for, I'm sure you have seen testosterone not recovering for sometimes years. So I personally prefer GnRH antagonist in the intermittent therapy setting.
So you prefer oral more than the...
injectable too as well, right? Either one.
Yeah.
That's a great point. All right, let's hear about the ESMO Presto trial.
Yeah, so Presto, this is a study designed and led by our colleagues at UCSF, Rahul Agrawal and team. So again, in the biochemically recurrent space, but a very different design. So right off the bat, I would tell you, don't compare Embark and Presto. Very, very different designs. And I'll get into some of that. So again, high-risk biochemically relapsed, defined by doubling time, defined by no metastases on conventional imaging. Okay, a patient has to have normal testosterone. Here, the primary endpoint is PSA progression-free survival, not metastasis-free survival. Okay, so again, a very different endpoint. You can't compare these studies. The three arms also are different. So again, the control here, arm one is LHRH analog. Arm two is LHRH plus apalutamide. Arm three is a combination of APA-ABI and LHRH. And in this case, all patients were treated for 12 months and then treatment was discontinued. There's no measurement of PSA triggering that yes-no decision. Beyond that first line of therapy, patients, the further treatment wasn't specified. And then you have your secondary endpoints, as you see there, PSA, testosterone recovery after treatment being a very important secondary endpoint that we'll look at here. So you look at the demographics of the study, and this is very typical for prostate cancer. The median age here is 66, 67. Most of our metastatic trials, it's closer to 70, but that kind of tracks and makes sense. Prior ADT at some point in about 40% of these patients. Prior radiotherapy, you can see in the majority, right? If someone had a prostatectomy, our first intervention is to do salvage radiation of the prostate bed before we start talking about BCR and doing systemic therapy. All right, so PSA progression-free survival. Again, there's the comparison is to the two experimental arms to the LHRH control arm. The two experimental arms are not compared to each other. And you can see in both cases here, the PSA progression-free survival is positive, favoring the experimental arm. So when we add an ARPI, an androgen receptor pathway inhibitor, to LHRH therapy alone, we get improved PSA progression-free survival. And then you want to make sure that improvement is not because there's delay in testosterone recovery, right? Because if until testosterone is recovered, the patient is effectively still on therapy. Just because you stop doesn't mean the patient's off therapy. But what you see here is that the testosterone recovery, right, in the APA alone, it looks essentially the same. APA shouldn't change it very much. Of course, ABI does lower testosterone levels, so you see, some slight difference there, hazard ratio 0.75. But in this case, the difference isn't very wide there in clinically meaningful terms. Then the time to MCRPC, and I would say that's the endpoint that matters most, right, in terms of overall outcomes, because as I say, metastatic disease is when we really start talking about a survival impact, right? These are the men that are going to 80-90% die of prostate cancer. And here you see again, the metastatic disease happening sooner when you do LHRH monotherapy. I mean, this tracks kind of with what we were seeing with Embark, right? And then this time to subsequent therapy, again, better early control, getting, better long-term control, time to subsequent therapy. And adverse events, I guess what I would say throughout all these trials is we're going to go through a whole series. There's no surprises, right? The adverse events don't vary according to the state of disease in which we're treating the patient, whether it's MCRPC, MHSPC, or in the biochemically recurrent space. So remember, with ABI, we get more of the hyperaldosteronism effects, the hypertension, the fluid retention, and impact on cardiac health. With Abby, we also have that 10% risk of hepatotoxicity. With apalutamide, much like Enzo, we've got some of that CNS toxicity, some of that hypertension. All right, now we're going to move through some of the MHSPC. We now call this APMS. PCWG4 is trying to redefine terms. And you know, Dr. Agarwal and I are both very involved in that. It's because patients hate the word castration, so we're going through this whole thing to just remove that word from the lexicon. Okay. All right, so walking through our MHSPC studies, and it's going to be one slide each, because I think you know this data, we've seen it, right? So we have four different RPs in this space. We have multiple different trials. All were positive. To elevate the conversation a little bit further, I want to focus on aspects of the high and low volume disease to help people really get comfortable with the idea that these patients have vastly different outcomes, right? So, you know, high volume was defined and charted as you know, four or more bone metastases or any visceral metastases or bone metastases outside the axial skeleton. Now, that four was a relatively arbitrary number that came up during study design, and people argued over three, four, five. We do a lot of this. We pick a number and go with it, okay? But it's held up. You get different outcomes. So we ask the question, do we see results holding up in both the high and low volume patients? And the answer with abiraterone and Stampede is unequivocally yes. Okay, so an unequivocally positive study, nothing to quibble about here. And then we look at it in Latitude. Now, with all these MHSPC studies, the designs were different in terms of inclusion criteria. Latitude only allowed patients with de novo metastatic disease. So we talked about high and low volume. The other thing to think about is metachronous metastatic disease versus de novo. The man who shows up with metastases at initial diagnosis, that's de novo, obviously is higher risk than the man who has a metastasis 15 years after his prostatectomy, right? The biology of the disease is, in fact, different. Outcomes are vastly different. So here's a pearl I'd have you go home with if you don't know this already. So for the man with de novo high-volume disease, on all these trials treated with LHRH therapy alone, median overall survival is 3 years. That's as bad as most of the other cancers we treat. This man needs treatment. He's not going to, you know, live a long time and die of something else. For the man with low-volume metachronous disease, median overall survival LHRH therapy alone is 8 years. Vastly different. And then the intermediate risk is the de novo low-volume or the metachronous high-volume. Okay, so Latitude was all de novo. You could see these patients, very high-volume population mostly. You know, you could see in the number of patients at risk, it's really 80% high-volume in the Latitude study. The low volume, such low numbers, you know, you don't see it play out, but Stampede was much larger numbers than this.
So before you go on, maybe we can just summarize, you know, what other data we have, but more importantly, how you approach patients in this situation. So Alan, can you just kind of, we really want to be able to get and talk about capivasertib in the Capitella trial because it's so new and it's so controversial. Can you kind of summarize where we are right now in terms of the issue of endocrine therapy of hormone-sensitive metastatic disease, how you approach it?
Yeah, so you know, if you look at the NCCN guidelines where we really do this distinguishing patients by de novo versus metachronous and high volume versus low volume, that's absolutely how I approach it. You know, I've spent a lot of time and research kind of establishing that paradigm of treatment. The outcomes for these patients are very different. The biology of the disease is different. You know, when we do the genomics of these different categories, they're actually much more aggressive, no surprise, in the de novo high volume, much less aggressive in the low volume and the metachronous. So, you know, the essential question, the biggest question is doublet versus triplet. In my practice, I reserve triplet for de novo high volume. In de novo high volume, I say triplet is the default, and I have to say, why wouldn't I give doci? For all others, doublet is the default, and then we go through the question of, you know, Abby, Enza, Darrow, Appa, you know, for the individual patient, which makes the most sense. And probably the other distinguishing data set, and I didn't get to it here, but, you know, there's a data set that says Abby's much less beneficial, probably a little more toxic in the patients over 75. So the older patients, I tend to go away from Abby a little bit. Younger patients, it's more in play.
So here's another triplet that just sort of came into being, so to speak, in the P10 deficient patient. And again, Dr. Fazazi presented this at the ESMO meeting, really a groundbreaking trial.
Yep. So really want to talk about this because this is the this is the newest data set. This is not yet FDA approved. It is going to the FDA, though, so this may be something that becomes available to you, you know, sometime in the near future. So P10 deficiency occurs in at least 40% of prostate cancers, and you know, we can kind of get into the nuance of, you know, when it happens, but it's a fairly early event. And so based upon the on the mechanistic impact of P10 deficiency, it becomes attractive to say, is there a way to target this very common event in prostate cancer? So P10 acts as a regulatory gene kind of downstream of the PI3 kinase AKT mTOR pathway. And when you remove P10, you end up with hyperactivation of this pathway, which can be an alternative growth pathway to the androgen receptor pathway, right? So AR is the dominant signaling pathway in prostate cancer. PI3 AKT signaling is a parallel pathway. With the loss of P10, you have hyperactivation of this pathway, then co-stimulating the prostate cancer cell along with AR, right? So now you have two hyperactive growth pathways in these prostate cancer cells. Of course, you know, if you are all practicing general oncology, you're familiar with then using capivasertib, other AKT inhibitors in breast cancer. It's really much the same concept. So in prostate cancer, the idea is, can we add capivasertib to androgen receptor pathway directed therapy to get improved outcomes in this subset of patients with P10 loss? So CAPItello-218 is a phase 3 randomized clinical trial looking in de novo MHSPC, so high-risk patients, okay, where P10 loss was defined by central testing by IHC. So it gets to this question that, you know, we heard earlier about how do you define, you know, the P10 level. And it's ABI ADT plus or minus capivasertib. Primary endpoint is in all of our MHSPC studies, radiographic progression-free survival. OS is secondary. And what we saw here was a positive study, relatively modest, kind of the hazard ratios that we've been used to in some of these other studies. HR came in at 0.81, but hits the p-value we're looking for at 0.034, right? So, you know, certainly a positive study. Proportional hazards are maintained throughout the follow-up period here. But here's the nuanced point. And so what we saw in this study, you know, pre-specified was to look at the P10 actual level of deficiency. So this question about how should we define it, because P10 deletion is the most common aberration in prostate cancer, but you get point mutations, and then you get these conversations around monoallelic versus biallelic, and what's the actual impact on the pathway? So in the study, we looked at the actual degree of the P10 score by the IHC. You see on the very top there, you know, all patients in the study, right? We had a positive study, but it was not maybe as much of an impact as we wanted to see. But you see, sequentially, as you get more profound P10 loss, you get a greater impact and a greater benefit on the study. Now, you look at the, you know, the number of events and the number of patients at risk, right? You have more patients in the kind of the 95%, you know, P10 score. You get only a fewer number of patients, about a quarter of them with the profound P10 loss. But in that population, the strength was even, the impact, the benefit was even more significant, right? So the immediate reaction of this data set as we look at this is to say, we've got active drugs. Capivasertib is absolutely doing something. It's absolutely benefiting patients. But we look and say, do we need to be more discerning about exactly which patients we should treat? Because, you know, as you all know, I mean, this is a toxic drug, right? Most of you are probably using this in your breast cancer patients. It adds a lot in terms of GI toxicity, in terms of some metabolic effects, right? The hyperglycemia, the hypokalemia, et cetera, right? So, you know, in these men with MHSPC or APMS who have a progression-free survival on the order of years, you know, we really think about, you know, how much toxicity are we adding for degree of benefit?
So I'm really curious to see your reaction to this, and we've been asking people ever since ESMO about it. I think the other thing that came out with the presentation that these people, first of all, have poor prognosis. I think the typical PFS was 2 years in the control arm. Also, Dr. Fazazi in the presentation brought out the fact that these patients frequently will have imaging progression without PSA progression. And again, I don't know if that's your experience. I was thinking maybe Uday has more experience with CAPI than probably most of the GU investigators. And I know you were asking me actually the question we heard Neeraj mention in terms of what type of testing. So fire away.
So a couple of questions here. Like, you know, P10 loss, like, you know, we are learning it. When do you test this? Like, you know, upfront in the prostate tissue or like, you know, bone biopsy you check? Like, you know, what is the yield on it?
Neeraj, and what type, answer your own question, what kind of assay? I mean, you can't get quantitation on an NGS, right?
Yeah.
Only an IHC.
So IHC is not currently a standard of care for patients with prostate cancer like in many other cancers, like breast cancer. You do IHC so routinely. So we still rely on NGS testing for P10 loss. And answering your question, Uday, when? This is early mutation. So it is, I do see some patients developing P10 loss when you test them at CRPC setting, but it's more likely because of the right tissue we are capturing. It's more like a truncal mutation. So I would suggest, in my practice, I do NGS testing for every single prostate cancer patient the first day I see them. So I don't miss the tissue, don't lose the tissue. So far, I'm sticking to NGS, but if this drug gets approved, I think the companion diagnostic will have immunohistochemistry, and then we'll start using it.
So my other question is like NGS testing on prostate cancers. Like as a general hematology oncologist, by the time patient comes to you, the urologist sends the patient, and they already give ADT before they're sending the patient to you. Like, you know, when you do the liquid biopsy, the yield goes down significantly. How do you, like, you know, when do you convince the urologist not to do the ADT before not sending the tissue, like, you know, sample for NGS?
I mean, maybe they can do the AKT and you add on whatever you want to add on as well. I'm kind of curious what your experience is with CAPI. You know, we were talking about this morning, obviously, with breast cancer. What's your experience?
I have one patient, like, you know, she developed significant rash with the livedo reticularis. I had to stop. Like, you know, that's a tough drug to tolerate.
Yeah, they were talking about the rash this morning in terms of prevention of it and aggressive management of it as well. And of course, you have the 4-day on, 3-day off, which also, you know, they were talking about this morning in terms of alleviating toxicity. So Neeraj, also, in addition to you, I met with Raina McKay, and she actually presented a case at the meeting of a patient who was AKT P10 deficient and had got the triplet, but had a poor PSA response. And she was saying, you know, if I could, I'd want to add CAPI. So my question is, A, would you want to, if you had CAPI available, would you add it in that situation? And B, what about just using it up front, just like the trial? Would you present it to a patient as an option?
Patients with P10 deficient prostate cancer has poor prognosis. The median PFS was almost half of what we see without P10 status. And that's a concerning very concerning sign. So that's number one. So going back, all these intensification trials have shown that even if you add the agent later, so for example, we have data from enzalutamide, apalutamide. If I see a patient who did not start these drugs up front, and then somehow a year has passed, patient is still responding to the ADT alone, but there is a reason. There is data to show that even adding enzalutamide or apalutamide late will improve survival. It's coming from the crossover data. So based on those data, if capivasertib is approved, and if I have a P10 deficient prostate cancer who could not start capivasertib because it was not approved, I will talk to the patient about starting the drug.
Interesting. Alan, any thoughts? If it were approved, would you present it to a patient?
Yeah, I would really look at that P10 deficiency data and try to be highly selective, right? I really think the degree of B10 deficiency matters. So I think the companion diagnostic is important. And then, you know, as oncologists, you know, we know how to manage toxicities. I think you're going to be very selective, right? I mean, if a patient's not tolerating it, it's okay to back off. But, you know, if it's approved, then I think we're going to have a role for it, absolutely.
And, you know, the more people use an agent, the better they're able to use it. I mean, I've seen over and over. I mean, Uday's unit used it once, and you talk to the breast cancer investigators, they use it 50 times, and you learn how to use it. So hopefully that'll apply here as well. All right, Neeraj, let's talk about there's so many other new agents, and again, really starting to move up into the hormone-sensitive space.
And many of the drugs I'll be talking about are not approved yet, so I will go just slide through those data. I have 10 minutes. So first of all, I don't have any relevant disclosures. These are the drug classes I will be talking about. Two of them are already approved in the prostate cancer setting. Rest three, I think, will be approved in the near future. I remain cautiously optimistic. So let's first talk about the PARP inhibitors. So we know about PARP monotherapy data in late stages of prostate cancer for a long time. Olaparib was approved based on PROFOUND trial data in 2019 or 2020. But more recently, we saw the combination of PARP inhibitor and ARPI. And these are typically those patients who Dr. Bryce was talking about, biochemical recurrent prostate cancer patients who get ADT, monotherapy, intermittent therapy, slowly develop mCRPC. So those three trials were in the first-line mCRPC setting where patients had not received the prior ARPI, or many patients, and there are some patients who received ARPI in the past. So this is a first-line mCRPC trial. You can see the design is very similar, except that in TALAPRO-2 trial and the MAGNITUDE trial, patient had to have NGS testing done prior to the enrollment. In the PROPEL trial, all-comer patients were recruited. So in this busy slide, what is the message here? Talazoparib plus enzalutamide trial, if you look at the overall survival data, because that's so important compared to every other data we have. So if you have overall survival, I like to focus on that. There was a 14-month improvement in overall survival in those patients who had HRR mutation positivity when they were treated with talazoparib in addition to enzalutamide. So in mCRPC setting, enzalutamide is one of the very commonly used drugs. And if you add talazoparib to that, survival goes from 31 months to 45 months. Even in all-comer patient population, and this indication is not approved by the FDA, so FDA only approved this for HRR mutation positive patients, 14-month improvement in survival is the highest magnitude of survival benefit we have seen with any drug, any combination in castrate-resistant prostate cancer setting. Other drugs, other combination are approved for BRCA1 and BRCA2, BRCA1 and BRCA2 positive patients, but TALAPRO-2 based approval is for all-comer HRR mutation positive patients. So beyond BRCA1, BRCA2, ATM, PALB2, and CDK12, and so on. So that's the message from this slide. Now, no surprise, these combinations are moving to hormone-sensitive setting or androgen pathway modulated sensitive setting. And the reason androgen pathway modulation was used because many of these patients are not getting ADT. They are getting maybe enzalutamide alone, so they are not castrate actually. So anyway, coming back to the topic, this is Amplitude trial. So we started this trial about 5 years ago, and you can see that these patients had homologous recombination repair mutations in hormone-sensitive setting. Patients with BRCA1 and BRCA2 comprise 53% or 55% of total patients, so pretty much driven by BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutation-positive patients. You can see the primary endpoint, radiographic progression-free survival, was met in both BRCA-positive patients and HRR mutation-positive patients. And if you look at the, if you dissect this further, time to pain progression was improved, overall survival is not met yet, but I think it will be positive in BRCA2, BRCA1 patients. FDA has approved this combination for BRCA2 positive patients only, primarily because the trial population comprised predominantly BRCA2 positive patients. Now, in the same setting, another trial, We started this trial about 5 years ago now, TALA-PRO 3 trial, so building up on TALA-PRO 2 success. In this trial, patients with HRR mutation positive MHSPC, they are randomized to enzalutamide versus the combination. And there was a press release just a few weeks ago. The trial met the primary endpoint. And we will see, hopefully in the future meeting, hopefully in a publication, how strongly the data are, because before we can talk about how to incorporate these data in the practice. Coming to the third PARP inhibitor, saruparib. This is a PARP 1 selective inhibitor. So you can see PARPs are coming in a big way in prostate cancer. And PARP 1 selective means theoretically they should have less hematologic toxicity. And this is the EvoPAR Prostate 1 trial. It is including both cohorts, unselected, meaning not unselected, patients who do not have HRR mutation positive disease and patients who have HRR mutation positive disease. Trial is enrolling, and we will hopefully see the results in the near future. Any questions?
So, yeah, where are we right now in terms of PARP, and I'm going to say the hormone-sensitive metastatic setting? Alan, is this just, I mean, I'm not just talking about approvals, but in terms of theoretically, where would you want to use it? Actually, Uday sent me a message to ask you that, actually. Is it just BRCA germline, BRCA somatic? What about PALB2, other mutations?
It's a great question, right? So,
Uday.
All right, so when we talk about the hormone-sensitive space, right, we have approvals now in the hormone-sensitive space with PARP inhibitor, RP combinations. You know, as we see with so many drugs, effective drugs, when you move them up, right, they're also effective. We don't get surprised by these results. So we absolutely have the option to use these combinations in the frontline setting. For men who have, if we get nuanced, because you asked the PALB2 question, right? The vast majority of the response is going to be driven by the BRCA2 patients. BRCA2 aberrations are going to outnumber BRCA1, maybe 7-8 to 1 in prostate cancer, you know, different than other diseases, ovarian or pancreas or breast, okay? So BRCA2 is the vast bulk of the patients. Those are the men who get the most response. ATM mutant disease has a ratio on that's right around 1, so it's not an HRR gene as far as prostate cancer goes. BRCA1, much less significant benefit than BRCA2. It's a very big difference. BRCA2, they respond well. BRCA1, modest benefit. PALB2 is one of the other genes where we do see a very nice response, high response rates with PARP inhibitors in prostate cancer. But those are relatively rare, right? I mean, that's like, you know, a 5% of the population of the BRCA2. So it's really small. And then there's that kind of tail of kind of less common aberrations that get included. You know, RAD51, you get some responses. CHK2, no responses. CDK12 aberrant prostate cancer, which is hyperaggressive, we see some benefit with talazoparib and olaparib. So there's a long list of genes to think about. But BRCA2 is the heart of it. In the MHSPC setting, when I see BRCA2 mutant disease, I'm absolutely thinking about getting a PARP inhibitor in early. But to the point we were speaking about earlier, and this is just my nuanced point in clinical practice, you know, if these men are going to get 3 years of response, I don't really want them to have 3 years of myelosuppression. So I think about, you know, kind of induction. I do maybe 6 months, maybe 10 months of the PARP, get a deep response, and then kind of back off and bring it back in later. That's not the way the clinical trials were done. They were all continuous therapy. But again, marrow toxicity, marrow preservation over the life of a prostate cancer patient is really important. I think one of the common final pathways of you know, end-stage metastatic prostate cancer is, in fact, marrow ablation. Older men, 70s, 80s, have had pelvic radiation, et cetera. They're getting radioligand therapy, chemo, PARP. So I'm really thinking about marrow preservation throughout. So I like to use PARP early, but I don't keep them on it for 3 years.
Yeah, I'll say that is an unusual approach to it. Not necessarily everybody does that, but let's move on now. And hey, here's another thing for hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. How about lutetium?
Yeah, so we know about lutetium radioligand therapy, which is targeted towards prostate cancer using the PSMA expression on prostate cancer. And this PSMA 617 is the carrier which carries this lutetium 177, the beta particle, all the way to the prostate cancer when we injected intravenously. So if you look at the data, in the VISION trial and the PSMA4 trial, these are the two approvals in the U.S. right now. So VISION was done after chemotherapy. So chemotherapy with docetaxel and ARPI. When patient had progressed on both these, then these patients were treated with lutetium PSMA versus a control. And half of these patients did not have any active drug in the control. And if you look at overall survival, that was 4 months improved with lutetium therapy in the VISION trial. And radiographic PFS was 5 months higher. Now, PSMA4 trial moves lutetium to before chemotherapy. So post-ARPI, mCRPC setting. Obviously, a lot of crossover. We will never see the survival data. But PFS data was about 6 months longer progression-free survival compared to alternate ARPI as the control. So control was not chemotherapy. It was alternate ARPI. If they got ABI, they got ENZA in the control. If they got ENZA before, they got ABI in the control. And both of these trials have led to approval of lutetium. Now, PSM addition is the first line, MHSPC setting. Same thing. These drugs are moving up front. So this is the trial design, where patients with any PSMA-positive lesion was allowed to be recruited as long as they had PSMA positivity more than the liver. So liver was used as the standardized organ to look at the comparison. And the data are, so median PFS have not been reached in both arms. These patients are living much longer, as Alan, you mentioned. So we see 28% decline in the hazard ratio is 0.72, 28% reduction in the risk of progression or death because of lutetium. Again, because of the crossover, we will likely not see the overall survival data here. So we have a drug. Hopefully it will be approved so that we have another option in the clinic.
Is that an option you'd like to use?
Well, I'll come to that in a second. Two more slides. So ProstACT Global is a trial where the control is chemotherapy. So we are doing this trial in the mCRPC setting, in the PSMA4 setting. And there are only two doses of lutetium required as opposed to six doses. And that's why I will come to the six doses, Dr. Love, in the metastatic hormone-sensitive setting. So two doses of lutetium and you are done. Because it uses an antibody, so it can carry a lot of lutetium upfront to the prostate cancer. And this is actinium, another novel ligand, radioligand. It is an alpha particle, possibly less toxic, but time will tell. Coming back to your question about, yes, I will likely consider, as we do for all patients, not everyone will get lutetium. I think I will go with, like we look for where PARP inhibitor is going to be most effective. I'm going to look for where lutetium is going to be most effective. High PSMA expressing tumors, high volume, and so on, and maybe not six doses. If they achieve a PSA level of less than 0.2 after two doses, giving any more lutetium, meaning that lutetium is going to go to normal organs and cause toxicities. So maybe I'll customize treatment in those patients. This is another exciting drug. It's called opevesostat. Hopefully we'll have a nicer name after approval. OP, maybe.
I like OP.
And it is like using this drug is like removing the adrenal glands medically. So all these patients require prednisone support, mineralocorticoid support, aldosterone, and so on. And this drug is being used in two phase 3 trials. This is the pre-chemo mCRPC and post-chemo mCRPC. These are the large trials. And we'll see if the trials are positive or not. The control arm is alternate ARPI. So we are hoping that removing the adrenal glands medically will remove all the residual androgens and will improve outcomes. So we'll look forward to the results of this trial. So basically, coming to the end, we have a lot of new therapies being developed, and I wanted to have a generic conclusion here that NGS testing is the key, testing is the key, PSMA testing, and so on. I think we are going to be personalizing treatment for our patients with MHSPC as well as mCRPC.
So we didn't even talk about ADCs and bispecifics, but I think it's about time for lunch. Again, amazing how much is going on in this field. Thanks so much to the faculty.